Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. This week, Germany's new chancellor gets off to a bumpy start.
Things don't necessarily bode well for the incoming coalition if already at the start you can't get a majority to vote for the new chancellor. The big question, obviously, and it's a question that, by the way, probably will have no answer, is who and from which of the coalition partners actually voted against Merz.
Is Google helping Turkey to strangle independent media? And bye-bye golden passports. Malta is forced to abandon a lucrative business model. Those stories and more coming up on the programme. It has been an extraordinary week in German politics. And yet, at the end of it all, we've ended up exactly where we expected to be, with Friedrich Merz as Germany's new chancellor, boarding a plane, first to Paris, then to Warsaw, in demonstration of his determination to not just be a German, but a European leader as well. Back home, however, Merz's political takeoff was anything but smooth. A parliamentary vote to confirm him as chancellor, something which had been assumed to be a matter of form, sent shockwaves through political Berlin on Tuesday when Merz failed to gain the requisite number of votes, forcing him into the humiliating position of having to submit himself to a second round vote, which he did then go on to pass. Our political correspondent, Thomas Sparrow, was, of course, following it all.
That was certainly a rocky start. I actually laughed yesterday because Der Postillon, which is a satirical publication here in Germany, published a picture of Merz. The headline is Merz after being elected chancellor, and then a quote, and it says, "It all worked okay, didn't it?" And then you see a photo of Friedrich Merz with his glasses broken, a missing tooth, a bloody nose, his jacket all torn and ripped.
He's been through the ringer, and even without the satirical spin, I think that was there to read on his face. And the thing that is surprising about this is the maths of it, right? Because Friedrich Merz's own party, together with its coalition partners, the SPD, they had the votes to simply wave him through, right? So the fact that that didn't happen means that there are people, either within Merz's own party or within the party with whom he is going into coalition, that do not trust him, that do not have confidence with him, or that wanted to send him a message.
And basically what already political analysts are saying is that that could be interpreted as a sign that things don't necessarily bode well for the incoming coalition if already at the start you can't get a majority to vote for the new chancellor. The big question, obviously, and it's a question that, by the way, probably will have no answer, is which of the coalition partners actually voted against Merz, because the vote was a secret vote. So basically, it's impossible to find out who actually changed his or her mind and voted against Merz, despite the fact that both the Conservative bloc and the Social Democrats had agreed or have agreed that coalition deal and had the necessary majority to simply pass that and get Merz very quickly on that morning as a new German chancellor. So what happened in the end is also actually important and interesting, because after that failed vote, the established procedure is that in order to have that second vote quickly, the actual proposal needs to come from the parliament itself. And there needs to be a big majority there from the parliament to get that second vote in place. And although some of the opposition parties clearly stated that they would vote against Merz, what they did say is that they would support a vote because they believed that it was in Germany's interest to have a chancellor in place and a government in place.
Right. And this is so important. And I think the really important party to highlight here is probably Die Linke, the left-wing party in the Bundestag, because they are ideologically, politically, very, very far from being aligned with Friedrich Merz's Christian conservatives. However, they did exactly this, right? They said, yeah, we're not going to vote for you, but we are definitely going to vote for there to be a second vote. And the reason for that is the danger of that they see coming from the AfD, who were very vocally saying, oh, well, this is a complete indictment of Merz and of the system. We need new elections, calculating that they would do very well in those elections. And that coming on the back of a decision by Germany's security services to categorise the AfD, and this is the entire party, not sections of it, as confirmed right-wing extremist. That means that the AfD now is categorised by Germany's own security services as a party which is actively working against the democratic order.
I don't know if both issues are directly linked, but they both happened very closely one after the other. So first, the domestic intelligence agency stressed that it was based on the fact that they interpreted the AfD's concept of people, that's how it was also translated, as ethnically and ancestrally defined. And basically what the intelligence agency said is that that devalued entire segments of the population in Germany, and that obviously violated their human dignity, and that therefore was against the German constitution. What it means in practical terms is that the intelligence service can step up its monitoring of the AfD. What all this basically means is that the debate politically is that the debate has now become more intense about a potential banning of the AfD. There are major hurdles here in Germany because of Germany's history to ban any party. So that's definitely not guaranteed that that would happen. But it is a debate that is now becoming more intense and that is obviously playing a role in parliament as well, in the debates, because what basically other parties in parliament are now saying is that when there are any discussions in parliament, any debates, any important decisions that have to be made, they are now dealing with a party that, according to Germany's own intelligence agency, is right-wing extremist. As far as the AfD is concerned, they say that this is a politically motivated decision.
And what about public servants, police officers, judges, and so on, who may be members of this party, given this new classification? Does that have implications there? There are so many questions, Thomas, and I don't want to go into them right now, because I think that's probably a discussion for another time. But just on a zooming out and looking at the importance of what's been happening on a European and even global level, there was big investment in the idea that this week was going to be the week where we would finally have clarity from Germany. You know, so many reasons to need strong leadership from Germany at the moment. And what Germany displayed this week was not really that, was it?
You say correctly, Kate, that the challenges are huge. The challenges are huge internally. And then internationally, you have the war in Ukraine. You have now the growing tensions also between India and Pakistan. You have the situation in the Middle East. You have all the differences with Donald Trump. And that also explains why not only the chancellery is in the hands of Friedrich Merz and his conservatives, but also it was important for him to make sure that the foreign ministry is in the hands of the conservatives. That is not something typical. Normally, I do believe that at least the first part of Friedrich Merz's time in office will be marked to a very large extent by foreign policy and by international challenges. And at the same time, obviously, with this economy, with all the political tensions and polarization here in the country, I don't expect it to be a very easy job for him in the coming years.
Our political correspondent, Thomas Sparrow, there. Just a quick update. Since recording that interview, the German Domestic Intelligence Agency has said that it will not publicly refer to the AfD as a confirmed right-wing extremist movement pending a legal challenge by the party. We will keep you updated in future episodes. Now, to press freedom. Reporters Without Borders has released its annual World Press Freedom Index. For the first time in the index's history, the conditions for practicing journalism are difficult or very serious in over half of the world's countries and satisfactory in fewer than one in four. It will not come as a surprise to anyone who has been following the recent mass trials of journalists reporting on the protests against the imprisonment of Istanbul's mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu, that Turkey is in the very serious category. And now, independent media voices are facing a new threat coming in the form of altered Google algorithms. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
RTTV ekranlarında Yekten Türk Yılmaz'la birlikte hazırlayıp sunduğumuz müdahil program.
These days, Turkey's small independent media broadcasters mainly reach their audiences through the internet, with traditional terrestrial outlets controlled by the state off limits. Despite intense government lobbying, Turkey once again fell down the World Press Freedom rankings this year, dropping to 159 out of 180 countries. Even on the internet, the survival of independent media voices is now in question. The US technology giant Google is accused of changing its algorithms, resulting in a collapse in people accessing independent websites, denying the media companies vital advertisement revenue. Duvar, one of Turkey's main alternative news portals, closed its doors in March, blaming the algorithm change. Erol Önderoğlu, Turkey's representative of the Paris-based NGO Reporters Without Borders, says that Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is set to tighten his grip on the media even further.
Mr. Erdogan has taken the control of more than 85% of national media, corporate media. So we have a few segment of critical media which nowadays try to contribute to media plurality in the country. The shutdown of Gazete Duvar was a clear alarming situation for many critical media. They complain mainly about this Google algorithm shift because they were, in a way, better prioritized in the past and they were getting real impactful resources.
Google was approached to comment on the accusations but didn't reply. But a spokesperson speaking anonymously to Reuters said any algorithm changes were simply aimed at enhancing the search engine facility. However, Volga Kuşçuoğlu, editor-in-chief of the independent news portal BRNet, says despite assurances by Google, there's been an alarming change in the search engine performance since the end of last year.
Google has very big effect. When you search the web for news, the most visible ones are always from pro-government media or state media, but the omission of independent media from results, that is just a mystery right now. We don't know whether any political pressure was, no reports have been made about that. The government has passed several laws in recent years and those were aimed at to bring large social media under control in Turkey. You wouldn't expect that Google would be excluded from this control. So yes, there could be political influence on the decision.
The opposition in parliament accused the government of pressuring Google to manipulate the algorithm, a charge both the government and Google deny. However, a raft of new legislation has been introduced to extend strict media controls that critics say restrict government criticism to social media and the wider web. Yaman Akdeniz is a co-founder of Turkey's Freedom of Expression Association. Akdeniz says the government's new draconian powers have already successfully brought to heel the internet giants, forcing them to open offices in Turkey, making them liable to Turkish law.
The government, in addition to warnings and financial penalties and advertisement ban, was going to impose a bandwidth restriction. So up to 50% of their access, bandwidth access, was going to be reduced. And that was going to go up to 90% of their bandwidth being restricted from Turkey. So that's why the social media platform providers did not want to risk that. And perhaps with commercial interests in mind, we don't know, they decided to have legal representation.
With some of Turkey's independent media organizations claiming a fall of as much as 90% in web activity in the past few months, many are now struggling to survive, being forced to fire journalists. However, Önderoğlu of Reporters Without Borders says the experience of Turkey could well be the canary in the mine, raising fundamental questions over whether large corporate organizations like Google should retain such power, given the importance of maintaining a broad range of voices in the media.
Instinction of pluralism within the media, which means that you would just have one echo from a country, which is the official line, which is extremely dangerous. This is the main concern, not only Turkey, but dozens of countries around the world. Journalists are trying to make viable another view within the society, another approach than the official one.
Questions over Google's power as the effective gatekeeper to the internet, and what critics claim is a lack of transparency over the algorithms the search provider employs, are likely to grow. Meanwhile, the algorithm changes leave Turkey's besieged independent media, already battling arrests and fines, locked in an urgent battle for financial survival. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
And despite all the well-documented horrors facing journalists in various parts of the world at the moment, it is that shrinking economic basis for good journalism which Reporters Without Borders are identifying as the biggest global threat to press freedom this year. So something to think about. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We're with The World, Public Radio's leading global news program.
We cover the biggest news events developing every day and give you the context you need to make sense of them.
And Carolyn, I also like our smaller stories, tales of discovery and human kindness, things that make us laugh.
Stories that kind of shrink our world and make us feel more connected.
Subscribe and listen every weekday to The World.
A passport to any country in the European Union opens doors to all 27 member states. And that is an opportunity so valuable that wealthy individuals outside of the bloc have been willing to pay hundreds of thousands of euros to get one. The possibilities for criminal abuse of so-called citizenship by investment schemes led almost all EU governments to end them. All that is, but one. Terry Schultz explains how it took a decision by the bloc's highest court to end Malta's money-making bonanza.
It had always bothered Maltese anti-corruption activist Manuel D'Elia that extremely wealthy people from outside the EU could just buy the citizenship he held so dear.
You cannot put price to citizenship. It's much more valuable than money.
The European Commission agreed, taking Malta to the European Court of Justice, the ECJ, to get it stopped. Here's Commission spokesperson Marcus Lammert on why granting access to EU countries in exchange for money is dangerous.
Such schemes raise security, money laundering, tax evasion and corruption risks for the Union as a whole.
D'Elia said the Maltese government tried to get around the European Commission's scrutiny of the fact that most people buying the passports had no connection to Malta nor intention to live there. They just wanted access to other EU countries.
The first law was amended to appease the European Commission and a residency requirement was introduced. But as you saw for yourself when you were here, this was a joke, that these were fake addresses. The government kept the addresses a secret. The few addresses that I gave you were a result of an accidental leak of data.
That's right. D'Elia referred to addresses he had shared with me. I was in Malta reporting on this story back in 2020, and with his help, I personally went to some of the so-called residences where passport applicants said they lived. Not a single one was a livable accommodation. Allegations of mishandling of the program had originally been raised by D'Elia's friend, the investigative journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia, who was murdered for her revelations in 2017. A foundation in her name set up to continue her whistleblowing work did a deep dive on the false address phenomenon in 2021. D'Elia shared some of their results.
They found even addresses of apartments on the fourth floor of buildings that haven't been built. The government thought they would go away with cheating the European Commission back 11 years ago by introducing this residency requirement and that the Commission wouldn't look further into confirming that the promises made by the government were being honored.
The government was also counting on its legal argument that any sovereign nation has the right to choose who lives there. And that brings us back to the European Court of Justice decision last week. D'Elia was expecting bad news because an opinion delivered by the ECJ's Advocate General last October had concluded Malta did have the right to sell its citizenship, despite the EU executive's misgivings. ECJ decisions most often follow these opinions, but not this time.
By establishing and operating an institutionalized citizenship investment scheme, such as the Maltese Citizenship by Naturalization for Exceptional Services by Direct Investment Scheme, which establishes a transactional naturalization procedure in exchange for predetermined payments or investments, and thus amounts to the commercialization of the grant of the nationality of a member state, and by extension that of union citizenship, the Republic of Malta has failed to fulfill its obligations under Article 20 TFEU and Article 4.3 TEU.
In short, and here in shortened form, the court said Malta's Cash for Passports program is violating its obligations under EU treaties. It ordered the program stopped immediately. D'Elia was shocked, in a good way.
I screamed a little.
He'd been working toward this goal for 12 years, but that earlier guidance from the Advocate General led him to expect a different outcome.
It went the right way, because where the court says every member state indeed has autonomy in deciding who it recognizes as its citizen, but it cannot do so purely on the basis of a commercial transaction, I felt that that phrase truly vindicated what we've been trying to say, that the scheme is not justified by the fact that it makes money.
But the money is something the Maltese government will miss. After the ruling, Prime Minister Robert Abela continued to defend the scheme, saying in a Facebook post that almost 1.5 billion euros had been earned from it, which has been, he argued, invested in saving jobs and small and medium-sized businesses and in voluntary organizations that work for the common good. Abela said the government would respect the ECJ decision, but through a, quote, framework that is in line with the judgment so that the people continue to enjoy the great wealth generated. What does that mean? Well, citizenship is no longer for sale, but EU residency is, and not just in Malta. Golden passports are now illegal, but golden visas live on and are still a concern for people like Anna Tyrone with the Brussels Office for the Global Anti-Corruption NGO, Transparency International. It's been working for many years to increase scrutiny of the practices.
A visa is restricted. It's not like citizenship in the EU, but still gives you access to many freedoms in the EU.
At least 16 EU countries offer visas for a certain amount of real estate investment. Here's Anna Tyrone again.
We'll see specifically the requirements. And for us, it's important to look at the type of investment that they're required and the physical presence in the country, you know, because if it's just a couple of days, then again, it's just a payment for visa and it doesn't show that you have any link to the country whatsoever.
Tyrone hopes the decision ending golden passports will have wider ranging repercussions to keep out what she called
corrupt and wealthy individuals who got their money in shady ways.
For Manuel D'Elia, the court decision is personal as a citizen of Malta. Besides reminding him that the reporting of his friend Daphne Caruana Galizia more than a decade ago was right, he said, it clarifies that citizenship is solidarity, and when you put a price on that, you cheapen it. Terry Schultz, DW, Brussels.
Our very own Charlie Shield, by the way, produced an episode of the Don't Drink the Milk podcast titled Passports, Freedom for Sale, and it's still on their podcast feed, so do check it out. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany.
Welcome to Those Who Can't Teach Anymore, a narrative podcast series that explores why teachers are leaving education and what can be done to stop the exodus. This season, we're getting a look at the year and the life of teachers from across the country through their audio journals.
I am Darcy Ostermiller.
This is Megan Overgoss.
This is Sophie V.
This is Charlie Blackwood.
This is Taylor Barron.
This is Iva Moss-Ridman.
This is David Whisker.
This is Dan Morris.
This is Amanda Smith.
Look for Those Who Can't Teach Anymore, Season 2, a different kind of the same thing.
On Living Planet, we've got questions.
Is anyone trying to clean up this mess?
Big questions. Should we really be sinking our money into this?
Questions that get to the bottom of things.
How much CO2 does a tree absorb anyway? Your questions.
How often do you think we should use the reusable cups to compensate for the paper ones?
But don't worry, we've got answers too. Answers to help you navigate some of the biggest environmental issues of our time. That's on Living Planet.
Find us wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. As we went to studio this week, ceremonies were underway across the continent to mark the 80th anniversary of the end of World War II. In many countries, May 8th is known as VE Day or Victory in Europe Day. And whilst it is a commemoration of the horrors of the past, May 8th has also often been seen as a chance to celebrate the achievements of the post-war era and of the emergence of a Europe which, until recently at least, often saw itself as a collective peace project. But was it really ever that? It's a question that I put to Natalie Tocci, director of the Institute for International Affairs in Rome.
So it obviously was, in the sense that after the death and devastation of two world wars, Europeans at that point understood that the only way to move towards a better future was that of turning the page over the nationalism that had devastated Europe. And the means to do it was gradually integrating their economies, and progressively through that economic integration, there would be a political integration. So in that respect, obviously, it was a peace project. I think it also was a peace project in the sense that it was a project in and for peacetime. Slowness was part of the recipe. And of course, if you do things slowly and carefully, then you have a higher chance of building a solid house. And in many respects, the fact that we're still here in a European Union that has progressively integrated over time is testimony to the fact that the house was and is solid. But of course, slowness is something that you can afford to do in peacetime. If we think about the condition today, we're in a context, on the one hand, in which we're no longer living in a peace context, but also we're living at a time in which empire and the ambition of empire is, you know, re-showing its ugly face, basically, in the world.
I really liked your image of the house. And I was sort of thinking that that house at the moment seems besieged. Russia's very much parked on the front lawn at the moment. And of course, the security patrol around its perimeter, that sort of role that had been occupied by the United States, that is being withdrawn.
So obviously, it's a more fragile house because it is threatened, right? And it is threatened by Russia. Then, of course, you add onto it the second threat, which has to do, in a sense, you put it in a rather benign way, which is, you know, a United States that is not as interested in European security and is basically telling Europeans, hey, guys, you know, you're on your own. It gets trickier when you see the intent coming from Washington today, so coming from the Trump administration, which is not necessarily that benign. And it's actually not about, you know, we stand aside and you Europeans look after yourself, but we actually have an active interest in weakening or undermining and certainly fragmenting and dividing you. And so this is, in a sense, not just an American indifference, but it's something more akin to an American betrayal. And then there's the sort of third and final, and in some respects, most acute threat, which is really a threat from within. And I mean this in exactly the opposite way from the way in which U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance meant it in Munich. And what I mean by the threat within is the rise of far-right nationalist forces in Europe. And of course, there's a connection between these three threats because, as we know, these far-right forces do have a strong domestic standing, but they are also supported quite explicitly, both politically and in some cases financially, actually both by Russia and by Trump's United States. And so, you know, we're speaking after the first round of the Romanian election, which was, of course, a rerun of an election. So we see the way, and this connects to the point that I was making earlier about Russia pursuing a political strategy as it tries to reconstitute empire looking towards the south. And it's really a rather effective one, right? Because if you think about what is happening indeed in Central and Eastern Europe, not only is Hungary already safely in Russian pockets, not only is Slovakia, but very soon we may see indeed Romania, elections coming up in the Czech Republic, which may well go in the very same direction. Bulgaria is always there kind of teetering on the brink. And of course, this is, you know, without even mentioning the rise of far-right parties in Western Europe, right? And so there's that threat from within, which is a threat to European integration, because a nationalist far-right Europe is by definition one in which the European integration project is basically hollowed out up until when it disappears altogether.
You described about a month ago in an article that really stuck with me when I read it in The Guardian, the kind of shapes that you see forming as Europe sort of shifts and adjusts. Maybe you could tell me a bit more about how you see Europe responding to this hostile climate.
So obviously this is a story which starts from, you know, what's the real need here? And the real need is obviously security and therefore its defense. And it's security and defense that passes through Kyiv. I think we should have clarity on that point. At the same time, it will involve a role, and actually quite an important role, I think, of European institutions, and in particular, the European Commission, particularly when it comes to the funding of many of these defense industrial projects. So it's the EU, but it isn't the EU. Then you kind of think, well, what is the other obvious place? Well, it's obviously NATO. And there, too, you're kind of stuck with a very ambiguous answer, because it isn't NATO to the extent that the only reason why we're having this conversation is that the US is checking out from European security in the best of possible circumstances, you know, the benign indifference rather than the malign working against. But either way, it's a NATO kind of without its majority shareholder, which is the United States. But at the same time, it is NATO, both because there are a number of countries which are not in the European Union and are in NATO and are in this discussion, like the United Kingdom, like Norway, but like even Canada and perhaps even Turkey. And much like in the case of the EU, there's value in having, for instance, the European Commission involved on the funding side. When it comes to NATO, there's real value in an institutional setup which has been up and running for many, many decades and which is actually quite good at what it does, right?
You didn't mention values. I mean, is that because the values are bound up with the institutions, or, you know, where does that come in?
So it's a really good question. So in a sense, it should be the premise of the entire conversation. You know, why is it that we're having this conversation about security and defense in the first place? So if we didn't have clarity as to the fact that the reason why we're investing in defense is to protect democratic values, then surely there are better ways of spending your money than on military capacities, right? So it only makes sense to spend on security and defense if there is clarity on those values. And by values, I don't mean something abstract, but I mean certain freedoms that constitute basically a democratic system and the democratic societies that we live in. However, I think that embedded in the question is precisely the entire threat to this exercise. Because what if in European countries you have a growing number of countries which essentially turn their backs on liberal democracy? And they don't need to do it overnight. They do it gradually, right? So it's a kind of gradual urbanization, both in geographic scope and in depth. Well, that Europe, which rearms significantly, we should be very, very worried about, right? And so I think, you know, both because of the, in a sense, positive reasons to engage in not just a conversation, but action on defense, but also the negative reasons of the threat basically therein, if we don't get that values piece right, is, I think, the beginning and the end of this entire exercise on European defence.
Hmm. Natalie, could I maybe ask where you will be on May 8th?
I'm actually going to be in Kyiv and very much looking forward to celebrating with them. You know, obviously not much the present and certainly not much the past on their end, but hopefully their future.
It's so interesting because when you said Kyiv, which is obviously a place at war, your voice softened. Is it because that is where the values are to be found right now?
I think so. I mean, you know, I kind of always think back when Ukraine applied for EU membership, literally days into Russia's large-scale invasion, which was in some respects the most counterintuitive thing in the world to do, when you didn't even know whether the capital would stand in a matter of days. And yet, on kind of closer inspection, it was the most obvious thing to do. Because again, if there wasn't clarity on the values, why on earth would Ukrainians have to resist Russia, right? And so I think, as I said, it's really the core of this conversation. And the reason why, as I was saying earlier, European security today passes through Kyiv, not just because of the kind of hard security end of the story, but also because of the political values that essentially all this represents.
So if Kyiv is the place of clarity, would that make Gaza right now the place of unclarity, a place where there isn't a common voice?
Well, I think it's even worse than that, because in some respects, Gaza is the place of clarity in reverse. It's basically the place where we have lost ourselves. You know, in some respects, Ukraine is where we found ourselves and refound ourselves and rediscovered the values that kind of bring us together. And Gaza is, in a sense, that place where we seem to have lost and, you know, tragically, we're actually quite united. You know, we're far too united in having lost ourselves in the values piece of the equation in Gaza. Putting out statements is not going to do the trick. We know this perfectly well. And in the case of Gaza, there has been absolutely no incentive by anyone in Europe to actually do anything to change the course of the events. And so we are, in the best of circumstances, assisting silently at war crimes and crimes against humanity being perpetrated every day. In the worst of circumstances, and I'm no lawyer, and it is up to the ICJ eventually to determine what this is, but hypothetically, there is also a possibility that the International Court of Justice will, you know, determine eventually that what we're living through now is a genocide in Gaza. And yet this is happening in a unanimous European silence, broadly speaking.
Natalie Tocci is director of the Institute for International Affairs in Rome. Human rights groups, including Amnesty International and a UN special committee, have found Israel's warfare methods in Gaza to be consistent with the characteristics of genocide, including use of starvation as a weapon of war. Israel denies the allegations. Now, you may have noticed that one of the possible European futures that Natalie set out in that interview revolved around the idea of a coalition of the willing. And in that department, France and Britain are already taking the first steps. They've announced that if and when a ceasefire agreement is signed between Moscow and Kyiv, they are willing to lead a European troop deployment in Ukraine in order to deter Russia from further aggression. It's a development that our Paris correspondent, John Lawrenson, has been following closely.
Le Premier ministre britannique et moi-même donnions mandat.
President Macron, speaking at the end of a Paris conference on Ukraine a few weeks ago that brought together France, Britain and Ukraine with some 30 other countries, including most of Europe, Canada and Australia, but not the United States, in what is being dubbed a coalition of the willing. Macron announced that France and Britain were coordinating a military coalition in support of a solid and lasting peace.
Pour une paix solide et durable.
He was, though, short on details. Jean-Dominique Mercher is editor of an influential blog on defence issues called Secret de France, or Classified.
Le président Macron a
President Macron hasn't said what this Franco-British-led force will be, only what it will not be. It will not, for example, be a peacekeeping mission with troops deployed on the front line to observe whether the terms of a ceasefire agreement are being respected, such as the UNIFIL mission in southern Lebanon, for example. It will not be a substitute for the Ukrainian army either, and it will not take soldiers from neighbouring countries such as Poland or the Baltic states and deployed them in Ukraine.
President Macron has described the military intervention he and his British counterparts are imagining for Ukraine as a reassurance force. Jean-Dominique Mercier again.
It's
a phrase that exists in NATO jargon. Reassurance forces exist. There are, for example, French soldiers in Estonia and Romania whose mission carries out this description. This is a force that would be deployed back from the front line at strategic sites to be decided with the Ukrainians, probably Kyiv, Odessa, and the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, for example. It's unclear what these soldiers would actually do, but their presence would, to quote the French president, deter further Russian aggression.
Pour, je cite le président de la République, dissuader une nouvelle agression russe.
So much for the role this force would play, but who will be taking part? Isabelle Lasserre is diplomatic correspondent of the Figaro newspaper.
Quand on creuse, il n'y a que deux pays qui sont véritablement allants. C'est,
When you dig into it, what you find is that there are only two countries really up for this, Britain and France, two nuclear powers that are really the only ones in Europe with the capacity to engage a military operation on foreign soil. There are other countries who say they would like to take part, but only if the United States provides what they call a safety net, by which they mean, at the very least, the support of U.S. military intelligence. And there are still others whose military capacities are too small or who don't want to take part because they're worried about negative public opinion at home. Indeed, it is true to say that in Europe, generally, public opinion is far from enthusiastic about the deployment of their troops in Ukraine.
Délirant parmi les partenaires européens.
There is then, in Europe, since the election of Donald Trump, the will to meet the challenge of a possible US military disengagement from the defence of Ukraine and Europe in general. The question is how strong that will is. For the moment, in any case, the deployment of this Franco-British-led reassurance force remains a possibility only. It will not happen unless there is a proper ceasefire. It would also probably require the acceptance of Russia, acceptance which Vladimir Putin has so far indicated he will not be prepared to give. John Lawrenson, DW, Paris.
From the uncertainties of the future to the lessons of the past next. That's here on Inside Europe with me, Kate Laycock. $50 million dead, 20 million in Europe, including 6 million Jews. That was the bitter reality on 8th of May 1945, the official end of World War II in Europe. We can't bring those dead back to life, but we can remember them. And that, I think, is the impulse that motivated David Kattenberg to complete his own very personal tour of a selection of synagogues in the Netherlands, a country that was brutally occupied by the Nazis and where some three-quarters of its Jewish population died in the death camps.
Jan Jeanette Engers Harschel, 54 jaar. Eva de Vries Harschel, 49 jaar.
A handful of teenagers read out the names of Alkmaar Jews deported by train on March 5, 1942 to Auschwitz, Sobibor, Bergen-Belsen and other Nazi death camps.
Hans Leon Frankenberg, 39 jaar.
Among the 172 names now inscribed in Alkmaar's black granite monument, my grandmother's nephew and his wife both perished at Auschwitz.
Albert Louis Blok, 30 jaar.
Marianne Blok-Duker, 28 jaar.
Down in South Holland, I visit the town of Sliedrecht, where Albert Louis Blok's aunt, my grandmother, hid from the Nazis along with her best friend Esther and eight others in March 1943. Dutch police seized them. A month later, Marta and Esther were gassed at Sobibor.
So I opened the door. Welcome.
My grandmother never got the chance to visit Sliedrecht's tiny synagogue. Today, though, it's open house, so I joined a couple of other visitors, curious to look inside.
We're just walking by, and we noticed somebody by the door, and my girlfriend said, well, let's look.
Have you ever been here before?
This is the first time. You know, I'm almost living here for, I think, 56 years in Sliedrecht, and this is the first time I entered the building here.
Ronald Kitz is the chair of the foundation that owns Sliedrecht's synagogue, the only synagogue in the world sitting on a dike.
As far as we know, the first Jewish families lived here from about 1770.
And they were Ashkenazim?
Yes, but Ashkenazim, yes. They came from German and Eastern Europe.
I gather this is the only synagogue in the world on a dike.
Yes, yes, we are very unique. Sliedrecht was a dike village, and there was no houses down the dike because it was more safe to make homes on the dike. So why not the synagogue also? And they did in 1845.
The Jewish community in Sliedrecht, it's not very big.
No, not anymore. There isn't. There isn't. There are a few families, but they are not religious. So when there is a meeting here, most of them came from other cities around. And that's not often. When we started, we had a service once a month and also the Jewish festivals. But a few families went to Amsterdam, a few families went to Israel. And then there were not enough Jewish people anymore because in the traditional service we need 10 men. Maybe you know that, a minyan. Yeah.
Sliedrecht's Dyke Synagogue is a small but lovely. Its handsome red wooden interior tells a sad story.
All this interior comes from another synagogue which had no Jewish community anymore after the Second World War. And we are very glad because it fits very well, but of course it has a sad story. It's crazy. The Jewish were not safe in our country. It's about 80% who were murdered. And nowadays, with all the bad news from the Middle East, but also from the Western Europe cities, makes them very voorzichtig, very careful. Well, we go downstairs.
Sliedrecht's Jewish community was small, never more than a few dozen. Ronald shows me a collection of their sacred objects.
We are proud about this because it's not just a menorah or just a prayer book or just a talit. These objects came from Jewish people which ancestor lives in Sliedrecht. And that makes it beautiful because every object has its individual story. And we are proud about that.
Next to mementos of Jewish life in Sliedrecht, a list of those who hid from the Germans in houses around town. One of them was my grandmother.
There were people who were hiding in Sliedrecht houses. And, well, here we come, which is a little bit personal for you, I know.
My grandmother.
Yes, she was here.
In search of other tiny Dutch synagogues, I go to Amsterdam, home to the Netherlands' largest Jewish community. The bells of Amsterdam's South Church echo off the pavement of the city's old Jewish district. Poor Ashkenazi Jews from Eastern Europe migrated here beginning in the late 17th century. Streets were narrower back then and lined with synagogues. Just one remains. Built in 1766 on a lane that no longer exists, the Eulenberger Synagogue now stands behind a brick wall. Maurits Jan Vink shows me around.
Should we go in? Yeah, this is a beautiful old synagogue, and we try to keep the spirit of the past alive as much as possible and transform it also into a place where people want to come in the 21st century. The upper level was meant for services. The lower level was more the community place for you could come and slaughter your chickens here, or you could come and have your wedding here, and you could come and get soup if you didn't have food for yourself. This part is where a lot of groups that came from Eastern Europe fled to. And this was also an area where there were a lot of synagogues. This is the only one remaining in the poor part. There were like 14 or 13 synagogues in the poor area. If you read the old papers, back then it was allowed to have 600 people in this building.
I mean, 600 people in here, it would have been packed.
Would have been packed. And knowing that there were no toilets and no conditions to wash your hands, you had to go somewhere else to do that. So, yeah, it was packed. But this whole area was packed. If you lived here, you lived with 10 people on 35 square meters. And the bathroom was outside, and there was one place to go and take a bath, not in the houses. This is the poor part of Amsterdam, and the people in this neighborhood were the people most affected by the Shoah, because they didn't have connections, they didn't have money. You needed money to go into hiding. On average, in the Netherlands, 75% of the Jewish population was killed. Here, it's 95%. So almost nobody returned from this community.
Some of those who never returned were talented composers and musicians. Among these, Leo Schmidt and Menachem Asher. Their music survives, performed by Imri Talgam for a packed audience in the Eulenberger Schule. Today, Eulenberger Synagogue is a popular venue for music recitals. Wahida Afriat helps organize them.
We are developing our own programming for like a Seder meal at Pesach or, you know, things like that. More activities surrounding Jewish tradition. Also have non-Jews involved. The building has a soul. It's historical, of course. And I love to be here.
Hans Leon Frankenberg, 39 jaar. Gertrude Clara Frankenberg Goldschmidt, 36 jaar.
The souls of old Dutch synagogues are all that remain of the souls of Jewish folk who gathered there before the Second World War, before the Shoah, back in Alkmaar. 172 of those names are read, along with the places the lives of Dutch Jews were extinguished.
Auschwitz, Birkenau, Bergen-Belsen, Mauthausen, Sobibor, Theresienstadt, Uwe Schar, Machanot Ashmat, Vegalut Europa.
David Kattenberg reporting from the Netherlands. Thanks to the Jewish community of Alkmaar, Sliedrechtsdijk Synagogue and Amsterdam's Eulenberger Schule. And thanks also to Imri Talgam for his piano passages by Leo Schmidt and Menachem Asher. You can find out more on Imri's webpages, imritalgam.com, and we will be putting a link to that in our show notes. That's it for today. This programme was produced by Charlie Shield and me, Kate Laycock, with help from sound engineer Ziad Abu Sleiman. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.